Welcome to Teneo Insights, a podcast that provides in-depth analysis on the issues that matter most to CEOs and their businesses. I'm your host, Kevin Kajiwara, co-president of Teneo's political risk advisory business. Let's get started.
We are 6 days into the new year, and I don't know about you, but I'm already exhausted. Clearly, many of us are justifiably focused on the events of yesterday. A shocking, if not surprising, event that will go down, I think, as one of the most shameful days in American history. And we're all preparing to adjust to a new administration, which is now only 2 very long weeks away. And we'll have plenty to discuss on U.S. politics in the future editions of this call, to be sure. But we are starting this year with the pandemic, the subject of so many of our calls last year, because it remains the most profound and immediate global challenge. Indeed, while an insurrection was underway in the Capitol yesterday, the U.S. recorded its deadliest day so far, 3,963 deaths yesterday. Light is at the end of the tunnel, and we will end 2021 better than we start because the vaccines are here. They are being deployed, and there are more on the way. Now, unfortunately, due to our own behavior, there's still an awful lot of illness, death, and economic disruption to come between now and that return to normal. But I'm joined for this discussion today by a very special guest. Richard Hatchett is the CEO of CEPI, the Coalition for Epidemic Preparedness Innovations. We're also joined by my colleague, Dr. Jerry Hauer, Senior Advisor to Teneo. Jerry was the Acting Assistant Secretary of the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Commissioner of the New York State Department of Homeland Security and Emergency Services. I thank both of them for joining me today. So, gentlemen, we have had about 21 million cases in the U.S. And at over 355,000 dead, COVID is the leading cause of death in the United States at this time. And obviously, the vaccines are going to be critical to ending the pandemic. So, Richard, let me start with you. You know, let's start at a high level, an overview sense, and give us your sense now that we're a month into the vaccine rollout of how it's going, you know, what you're seeing and how you see things playing out right now.
Great. Well, thank you, Kevin. And thanks to everyone who's joined the call. It's a real pleasure to be here. We are in the midst in the Northern Hemisphere, particularly in the United States, also in the United Kingdom where I am, in the midst of what will undoubtedly be the most intense and largest wave of the pandemic. Most countries experienced the wave in the spring, had some degree of a break, you know, over the warmer months, and now things have really picked up and are moving intensely and moving very, very fast. And Kevin, you mentioned the nearly 4,000 deaths yesterday, which is, you know, just extraordinary. Almost 80,000 deaths in the United States during December, and there's a very reasonable possibility that there could be many more than that in January. So there is the greatest urgency, both in rolling out vaccines as quickly as we can possibly get them out, and in maintaining the social distancing interventions and the disease transmission suppression efforts that we have in place. They aren't working very well, and they likely, we will see bumps because of people moving around and visiting people during the holidays. You know, that is going to add to the transmission burden. The challenge with the vaccines, I mean, besides just the logistical challenge of getting the vaccines out to places where they can be administered, the challenge with the vaccines that we have been currently approved, the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines in the U.S., the AstraZeneca vaccine being added to that in the U.K., is that they are two-dose vaccines. And while we think you will receive some protective benefit from the first dose, the full benefit, the 94-95% protection that the Moderna and Pfizer vaccines afford is not thought to be provided until, you know, at least a couple of weeks after the second dose is administered. So beginning vaccination now, you would anticipate if you receive vaccine now, you anticipate being protected in the middle of February. And that is an ineradicable barrier to protecting the entire population. Then when you add to that the logistical challenge of distributing vaccine and different states in the United States having different mechanisms in place and different plans in place for distributing that vaccine, adds enormously. And of course, in the U.S., lots of commentary about the perceived slowness of rollout to date and efforts to really ramp that up. And here in the U.K., you know, they're talking about trying to get out, you know, 2 million, even 5 million doses a week because of the same sense of urgency. The one other challenge that we're going to face, and this is, you know, a communications and a risk communication challenge, is that we are going to have multiple vaccines being distributed, and the vaccines may have different administration schedules, different side effect profiles, and they're all being introduced at the same time. And I think the potential for that to play into, a residual of vaccine skepticism, vaccine hesitancy in a context where the response to the pandemic has been highly politicized, you know, creates a potential for a lot of resistance in a significant portion of the population to receiving vaccine. And I think it's going to be important for those of us in the public health community, you as corporate leaders, you know, to communicate to your, you know, the your workforces and the populations that you have the opportunity to communicate with. You know, getting vaccine is important to protect individuals. It's important to protect society, and it is what individuals can do to help fight the pandemic. And the more we can do to increase the population's interest and willingness to be vaccinated, the quicker we're going to get out of the pandemic. Let me stop there, Kevin.
Well, that's a superb laying out of the situation. So I want to start unpacking a lot of what you just talked about there. You referenced the slow rollout that we have seen so far, and I just want to make clear, are we seeing at this point, now I'm not talking about down the road yet, but are we seeing at this point a shortage of vaccine, or is it the logistics? I mean, in the U.S., there's been shipment of over 15 million doses, my understanding, but only 4.5 million people have been vaccinated. And even here in New York City, which is not a difficult place to get the vaccines to or to store them, and no shortage of health professionals. We've received 480,000 doses as of Tuesday, but only vaccinated 118,000. What's the holdup here?
Well, I'm going to say that I'm not directly involved in any of the U.S. Or state planning efforts, so I certainly don't have any privileged insight into what the immediate challenges are. I'll offer anecdotally, talking to family members seeking to find vaccine who are interested in being vaccinated. They've had challenges, and it may be because of the state communication plans. But even people that are interested may not know where to go or how to access vaccine. And so it's likely to be a multidimensional problem. I did work in the White House of President Obama. I was asked to help, you know, coordinate the response to the 2009 pandemic. That was the H1N1 or swine flu pandemic that I hope people, you know, will mostly have forgotten about, because we think it was reasonably well managed. And initially, you know, vaccine first began to become available probably in late September of 2009. And at the time, we you know, as we had planned for the fall vaccination campaign, we had hoped that we would have about 100 million doses of vaccine ready for distribution by the beginning of October, or even distributed by the beginning of October. And we ran into manufacturing challenges. The vaccine yields were low, by the end of October, we only had access to 30 million doses. So there's a manufacturing component. How much is coming off the line? Then there's a rollout problem, a problem of, you know, a centralized procurement and then distribution to the 50 states and the territories. And that presented very significant logistical challenges. And then once the vaccines got to the states, there's a distribution and a last mile problem. We had that same challenge in 2009. I don't know if the root causes of the current situation are the same, but I wouldn't be surprised if they were.
Yeah, let me bring Jerry into the conversation then. So understanding, Jerry, the supply chain complexity that Richard just laid out, what's your sense of the holdup or the slowness of the rollout so far?
Well, thanks, Kevin. Good morning, everyone. And Richard, always great to be with you. When you look at what's going on now, unlike the H1N1 that Richard had helped manage through the White House, where there was a coordinated effort, there has been a very disjointed effort with the rollout of this vaccine. The states were basically told that to prepare plans by November 1st, they, by and large, had those plans in place. The problem was that they were not given the funding and they were not given the infrastructure to help get those vaccines out to people. There's also been the challenge of the two vaccines themselves, the Pfizer vaccine having to be kept at an extremely low temperature, Moderna's vaccine, a much warmer temperature, which makes it easier to manage. So distribution becomes a challenge when at this point in time, the healthcare systems are so overburdened that they really don't have the staff or the ability, the infrastructure to deal with vaccine rollout. And there needs to be more federal assistance in getting out, whether it's the military or the public health service, to assist in instituting the plans the states had written to deal with this pandemic. We're seeing, when you look at this, California has received over 2 million doses, but only used 29% of those doses. New York, 32% of the 934,000 doses they've received. Interestingly, Tennessee received 328,000 doses and has vaccinated at this point in time, 169,000 people were used 51% of the vaccine. So that's an interesting juxtaposition because Tennessee has so much of a rural population, you would expect the challenge to be even greater there. And New York, with big cities, should be able to get a lot more vaccination done, and it just doesn't seem to be happening.
So, you know, I want to follow up on that because obviously, you know, we also know that the U.S. has on order only enough to cover 185 million Americans by June. So there is a pending shortage out there, unless that's rectified. I want to get to the vaccines themselves in a minute here, but we've, you know, obviously we've gotten to the point now where in the U.S. and the U.K., people are, those who got the initial jabs are, it's timing-wise, it's time to get that second jab. And Richard, we're hearing a lot of talk out there, both in the U.K. and in the United States, about trying to stretch the dosages out. In other words, either cutting doses in half or extending the period between the first and second jabs from the 3 to 4 weeks that we originally heard about to up to 12 weeks, I'm hearing in the UK right now. The argument being, I guess, getting more of the population at least some protection is better with the transmission rates being what they are and the healthcare system capacity issues Jerry just mentioned. What do you think about this talk? Is it premature considering the lack of data, or is it safe? What's the public health perspective here?
Well, so on the this idea of maximizing the number of people that have at least some exposure to a vaccine, a first dose of vaccine, this is a trade-off that those of us, Jerry and I, used to talk about this in public health preparedness all the time. You know, and it's not just this virus. It, you know, people have modeled this because we've always thought that most new diseases would require two doses of vaccine, and you would be in a scenario where you might want to cover a large percentage of your population. So one dose versus two dose trade-offs is something that has been looked at extensively theoretically. Now the question that you've asked, you know, is it safe? Is it justified by the data? The AstraZeneca vaccine in particular, because of the way the clinical trials were conducted, in the UK largely looked at clinical trials that were completed in the United Kingdom and in Brazil, they actually had a pretty significant dispersion of subjects in the clinical trials, some of whom got their second dose 4 weeks after the first dose, but many of whom waited as long as 12 weeks. So they actually do have some data. That hasn't been presented publicly yet. It is my understanding is it's going to be put out very, very shortly to show the basis of the, or at least the data that was shared with the UK regulatory authorities and which led the UK regulators to approve the vaccine with a fairly long potential dose interval. 4 to 12 weeks is what was approved in the UK. And so in the UK, the vaccine is going to be used within the labeled indication as provided by the UK regulators, which is based on data. Now, the question is that data sufficient? How robust is it? How confident are we that the 12-week interval provides the same degree of protection? It's something that people will debate about. The idea of using just a single dose and dispensing with the second dose, would not be justified by data. There have been discussions in the U.S., as you say, with using a half dose. Let me give you the context for why we're having these conversations. I described the situation in 2009 where we thought we were going to have a lot more doses by the beginning of October, and we ultimately didn't have a very substantial supply, and even then it was only enough to cover a third of the population by the end of October. The pandemic in 2009, which was a pretty mild pandemic altogether, caused about 12,000 deaths in the United States total, peaked, if I'm remembering correctly, around October 20th, right as vaccine was being rolled out. And then it declined, pretty rapidly at the end of October and through November. And by the beginning of December, pretty much the fall wave was over. At the end of the day, when CDC went back later, after administering 80 million doses of vaccine and after spending billions of dollars developing the vaccine, because that rollout was late, they estimated that the swine flu vaccine saved about 220 lives out of the 12,000 people total, compared to the 12,000 people total who died. And so, if you have a vaccine and if you're going to provide protection with that vaccine, it is urgent to get that protection out as quickly as possible. And we're right in the midst of this intense winter wave. So that's the urgency that is driving public health authorities to consider these alternatives, which sound pretty radical and sound untethered from the scientific data that we've got. And it is critically important that we use science to inform our decision making you know, that's absolutely critical. And if we are going to, if public health authorities are going to choose to make these kinds of recommendations, it's absolutely imperative that they collect the data to support those decisions in real time as quickly as they possibly can.
Got it. Jerry, let me return to you here. And can you, let's step away from the vaccines for just a moment. Maybe you can give us an update on the state of the pandemic as you see it right now. I mean, your dark prophecies last year of what the holidays, starting with Thanksgiving and going through year end, would portend were prescient as ever. So where are we as we're going through this post-holiday surge? When do you see the peak occurring at this point? What are you seeing out there?
Well, Kevin, unfortunately, you know, I kept harping on behavior as we had our discussion last year. And the numbers seem to bear out the fact that people's behavior has caused this ongoing increase in the number of cases and the number of deaths. We had somewhat of a trifecta. We had Thanksgiving, then Christmas, then New Year's. So people gather at Thanksgiving, the virus spreads, increases the number of people with the virus, who then wind up at Christmas, where the virus, then they gather again, the virus spreads even more, and then we wind up with New Year's, and we have more people with the virus, and it continues to spread. So at this point in time, I think that the most difficult days are still ahead, and that could be right through the early weeks of February. I think that if we can accelerate vaccine distribution and people try and use public health measures, mass distancing, and as we've seen in some places, more stringent lockdowns or restrictive gatherings, office closures. Obviously, there's a real balance between the economic impact of closing offices and businesses, but these are tough decisions that need to be made. And I think if all of this is put in place, and we can really get aggressive with vaccine rollout, with more stringent public health measures for a period of about 3 or 4 weeks. And if fortunately there's no major events coming up, no major holidays, no major reason for people to gather, then we can start to see either a plateau in the number of cases or a gradual reduction during February, then March, then April, and we start to see the light at the end of the tunnel. But central to all of this is going to be behavior and vaccination. You know, the having the vaccine available is very important, but you have to get the vaccine in people's arms for it to have the public health impact.
What are you guys seeing in terms of trends in uptake willingness? I mean, obviously, there's been a lot of talk about, you know, anti-vaxxers or those who are just concerned at this about in the record time that these vaccines came to market, and particularly with the first two, which are, you know, with this messenger RNA technology, novel in the world of vaccines. So what are the polls saying on this? But also, is there a demonstration effect? As all of us sort of wait in line, we are seeing friends who are in the healthcare industry or what have you getting the shots. They're not, you know, they're doing well. You know, we also see some people trying to jump the line. Oftentimes, you know, sometimes famous people, people of means. So all of a sudden, everybody says, well, wait a minute, those people get it. I also want to get it as well. But we've obviously seen disparities in healthcare, particularly for communities of color. But they also happen to be on the front lines and most vulnerable in many cases. And we have the added challenge. You guys have both spoken about the sheer array of vaccines available, and that will be available. You know, and we're seeing different efficacy rates. Pfizer and Moderna obviously set the bar high. But I'm assuming when you go into the doctor's office or into the pharmacy, there's not going to be a vaccine sommelier there. I mean, you're not going to really have a choice, are you? I mean, what are you seeing in terms of the uptake willingness here?
Gary, you want to go first?
Sure. Thanks, Richard. At this point in time, there still is a lot of hesitancy, but I think we've seen a steady increase in the willingness of people to take the vaccine. I think that these are both, the two current vaccines are both safe. We're not seeing problems with the vaccines. I think that's giving people a level of reassurance. We're certainly hearing from the anti-vaxxers, and I think that's something that's been a constant with any vaccine, particularly a new one. But I think the number of people willing to take the vaccine has risen steadily. But Richard, you might have a different perspective on it.
No, Jerry, I don't. I think the ferocity of the winter wave that we're going through and these daily death numbers, coupled with the availability of the vaccine, you know, is certainly increasing the public's appetite. Maybe offering a global perspective, you know, I do think before the vaccines were available and before we were deep into this wave, which makes people more interested in receiving the vaccines, there was a potential for kind of a perfect storm. You have new technologies that people aren't familiar with, rapid development of the vaccines, people concerned that, you know, we'd be cutting corners, even though we were not improving safety and effectiveness. Politicization of the response creates a lot of distrust and vaccine uptake. Most informed authorities say that vaccine uptake is really a function of trust in the authorities that are recommending the vaccine to you. And when that distrust or when there is distrust, those vaccine uptake rates go down. In some of the European countries, the polls, you know, were showing, you know, really low numbers. I mean, France probably has the highest rate of vaccine hesitancy or resistance of any country on earth. And their polls were saying that only about 40% of the population was going to seek vaccination. And I have heard from colleagues in Africa of a lot of, they're getting signals of a lot of potential hesitancy for, you know, historical reasons and the same factors that impact, you know, communities of color in the United States. So we'll see. But I think Jerry's sense, my sense is very much aligned with his subjectively that, you know, a real increase in interest. And if we could make the vaccine available, there would be a lot of uptake.
Jerry, then beyond the willingness of individuals to take it, I mean, what are you hearing or what are your thoughts with regards to compelling vaccine use by employers, by, say, airlines and other businesses of allowing consumers to use their products, this concept of sort of a vaccine passport? And can corporations in in an effort to accelerate the rollout, can they themselves become points of dispensing to their employees?
Well, Kevin, the federal agencies have made it clear that employers can require an employee to be vaccinated before they come back to work. In fact, in the kits that are being distributed, there is a vaccine card that shows that you've been vaccinated. I think that obviously in the healthcare setting, requiring vaccination is very easy. It's going to be a lot more difficult in office settings, particularly since people have the option of staying at home. But I do believe that at this point in time, a lot of businesses will require a vaccine certification. And I think at some point, we might see the airlines, particularly in traveling overseas, asking for a vaccine card or certification. I know there's a lot of mixed emotion about that, but I think that the U.S. government, in giving employers the go-ahead to require, allow them to require a proof of vaccination, has opened the floodgates somewhat.
So I want to return just to the virus itself here for a second, because obviously much is being made of the mutations, particularly the strain that was first identified in the United Kingdom. It's now clearly here in the United States as well. It's reputed to be highly transmissible, if not more deadly in and of itself. But Richard, is there any, and I know that epidemiologists and virologists and whatnot fully expect mutations to occur. But is there any reason to think yet that that the vaccines will be ineffective against any of these mutations? I mean, is it a dangerous moment in a sense when you've got a partially vaccinated population and rapid transmission? I mean, is there a I don't know what you want to call it. Is there an evolutionary pressure on the virus to mutate in a more vaccine resistant direction?
Right now, with so few people vaccinated and frankly, so few people, protected by natural immunity from actually having survived infection, there's not a lot of pressure on the virus. I think the mutations that we are seeing, I mean, they are significant, and they do represent what was of great concern about the South African and the UK variants that have emerged is both the number of mutations, which is significantly greater than the mutations that have been seen previously, which, you know, as you say, RNA viruses, continually mutate. I mean, that happens at a certain rate. But what we were seeing was a concentration of mutations in parts of the virus that were going to have biological significance. And some of the mutations, particularly in the South Africa virus, are in regions that we believe would allow for escape from at least some of the antibodies that people would develop naturally and that the monoclonal antibody therapeutics that we've developed target those regions and so might allow escape from the therapeutics that we've developed. And I think most of the virologists that I've talked to, because when you vaccinate somebody, you elicit a what's called a polyclonal response. Your body generates tens or hundreds or thousands of different antibodies against the thing that you're being vaccinated against. And the diversity of that immune response is likely to overwhelm the mutations that we're currently seeing. So most virologists are reasonably confident that the vaccines are going to have continued high rates of efficacy. But it does put us on notice that the virus can change. And one of the theories about why these mutations have emerged is that perhaps these were mutations that evolved in possibly immunocompromised patients with prolonged infections, or who received multiple therapies where selective pressure was put on the virus, and thus these new variants have emerged. And what's very clear is, based on the epidemiologic data, is that they do really appear to be more transmissible. And in certainly with the UK variant, when you are looking at viral loads, there is clear evidence that viral loads are increased, which could both enhance transmission and potentially result in, you know, more severe disease, although that hasn't been demonstrated yet and would be very difficult in the midst of an intense fall wave where you're already overwhelmed in your healthcare system, very difficult to make a determination about that at a population level at this point. But it puts us on notice that we need to be ready to, implement changes in the vaccines if vaccine-resistant strains emerge. And of course, we have an experience with that with flu all of the time, which is under continual immune pressure and continually evolves to the point that we have to make adjustments in the vaccine. We need to be prepared. We need to be thinking about how we're going to do that with the new COVID vaccines and do that as quickly as possible in the event that these vaccine-resistant strains emerge. But right now, the virology community has reasonable confidence that the vaccines will continue to work. And we at CEPI are actually funding work to evaluate that through a number of partner institutions where we're actually testing the viruses. And so we're going, and I think a global surveillance effort, will be initiated formally very shortly.
Well, Richard, let me ask you a quick question, Richard. What's your thinking about the need for, if the variants are not so great that there's a need to change the vaccine, what is your thinking at this point about the need for boosters on a yearly basis or some schedule at this point in time?
Well, we know that the immune response to vaccination, to all vaccinations will wane to some extent. For some vaccines, it can provide lifelong immunity. We have some initial data, about some gradual waning of immunity with the vaccines we've got, but or to natural infection as well. But we've only experienced this virus for years, so we just haven't accumulated enough time to really understand what the likely put of reinfection will be for the population at large. We've had isolated instances, clearly, where people have been infected twice. But, I think time will tell. If I had to sort of take the temperature of the virology and immunology communities, I think they anticipate that this is the kind of virus that we will likely need boosters for over time. What isn't clear yet, Jerry, is what that interval is going to be. Is that going to be a short interval, or is it going to be a 5-year or a 10-year interval? But odds are we'll likely need boosters. We'll always have portions of the population that are at risk. So I do think there's an anticipation that there will be a ongoing need for effective vaccines, essentially out as far as we can see.
Great. Thanks, Richard.
And Richard, on this point, we made the point at the beginning of the early in the call that the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines are notable not only for how fast and how effective they seem to be, but also the fact that they are using a novel technology, the messenger RNA basis. And obviously, tens of thousands of people were involved in the trials. But we're now getting to the point in terms of deployment where we can start to see the proverbial one in a million type effects. Is there anything that's appeared, anything that's an issue in your mind that would not have been anticipated with those two in particular?
No, not really. I mean, people have heard about the reports of allergic reactions, and a publication has just come out that's beginning to look at that. And of course, as part of the post-marketing requirements for the vaccines, you know, we will continue to monitor for these very rare side effects. I mean, one of the challenges, particularly in the context of a pandemic, when you're rolling out new vaccines very, very rapidly, is that if you give vaccines to millions of people, the kinds of events that would occur if you were just observing a population of millions of people will continue to occur. So, you know, if you vaccinate 5 million people in a month, you know, some number of those 5 million, you know, it might be just a handful, but they're going to drop dead within a few days of receiving the vaccine. It doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccine caused their death. And so it becomes really, really important to try to understand the background rates of, you know, heart attacks and strokes and, you know, sudden death and any other event that you might be concerned about in the population that you're vaccinating. And if you're targeting, you know, as you know, the priority groups for COVID vaccine are going to be older populations, which are going to have higher rates of risk for these events. And the reason I mention this is the power of the anecdote in you know, making somebody maybe decline to pursue vaccination can be pretty powerful. If you hear a news story about someone in your community who was vaccinated and then had a really bad event or developed a neurological condition, you know, that and they show images of that individual, that's going to have a strong impact on you. You need to resist the instinct to connect the bad event necessarily with the vaccination until that can be properly evaluated and looked at. And there will be very significant efforts to look at all of these new vaccines, look at these adverse events, severe adverse reactions, and try to determine whether they are likely connected to the vaccine or just bad luck, as it were.
So I want to move on to the experiences you're having and the challenges you're facing with regards to COVAX and vaccine deployment around the world, because I know this is very important to you and to the efforts of CEPI. But maybe this is the segue here is to talk a little bit more about the vaccines for just a moment, because clearly, you know, vaccines beyond the Pfizer and Moderna ones are going to be of critical importance to a lot of the rest of the world, some of which are still anticipated. And love to hear your thoughts on some of these, like, say, the Johnson & Johnson, which is a one jabber without the cold storage requirements. So potentially very valuable in hotter places around the world. But also, you know, we're hearing a lot about these Chinese and Russian vaccines as well. There's obviously a dearth of data, of trial data. On the other hand, you know, there's years and decades of experience developing pharmaceutical products in both of those countries. Any reason to think that these aren't effective or aren't safe products in terms of what we're seeing so far in their rollouts around the world?
Well, I mean, I think we do want to see the data. The first of the Chinese vaccines, the Sinopharm vaccine, which is an inactivated vaccine. Basically, they took the virus and you kill it, and then, you know, you would administer the virus that can no longer, you know, cause disease and produce immunity. I mean, it's a classic way to develop vaccine. It's long established. It can be tricky. It's not always easy to develop inactivated vaccines, but there's, you know, theoretically, of course, you know, it should work. And the Sinopharm vaccine has now been licensed in the United Arab Emirates and a couple of other countries in the Middle East, and also licensed in China. And they have reported, although I haven't seen a peer review presentation of the data yet, you know, efficacy, you know, between 79% and 86%, which is, you know, that's a really solid vaccine. And there's no reason to think that it shouldn't work. The Russian vaccine is actually a really interesting vaccine scientifically. It requires two doses, but the first and second dose are slightly different forms of the vaccine. And there's good theory behind why you would do that. And the Gamaleya Institute, which has developed the vaccine, is well reputed internationally, you know, for its scientific work. And I've talked with colleagues in the pharmaceutical industry who, you know, are quite complimentary of, you know, the Russian clinical trial capabilities and who often perform clinical trials in Russia because of the quality of the clinical trial results that they receive. And so we haven't seen the data, but the people that are making the vaccines are experienced. The theory behind the vaccines is good. One of the concerns that's often articulated about vaccines, you know, coming from China, from India, from Russia, relates to the quality control mechanisms that are in place for manufacturing. And I think it will be really, really important for those vaccines, if they are to be embraced globally, to go through processes with stringent regulatory authorities that are recognized by the WHO, and to go through, WHO has a regulatory group that extends it's basically a seal of good housekeeping called pre-qualification. And, you know, if these vaccines can achieve pre-qualification, that should increase global confidence in their use outside of the countries of origin.
So tell us a little bit about what you're seeing and what you're experiencing and the challenges you're facing with CEPI and via COVAX around the rest of the world. I mean, you've already brought up a couple of things, and these are more in rich countries, but it just goes to show the disparity of experience, right? I mean, France, you mentioned, where the UK has, you know, has had well over a million vaccinations, and France has done under 1,000, something like that. And Israel, on the other hand, has vaccinated approaching 20% of its population already, albeit a small country. Talk about what you're seeing out there, but particularly with regards to the lesser developed world. And for the benefit of our audience, you know, is there a role for corporate America to play, you know, in terms of improving that situation in much of the rest of the world?
Yeah. Well, I mean, the biggest concern that we have, I mean, we would argue that the reason that we have created the vaccines is to end the pandemic, and that while vaccines are a scarce resource, we want to use them to greatest effect towards the goal of ending the pandemic. And we don't think there will be enough vaccine globally to end the pandemic globally by the end of 2021, if by ending the pandemic you mean ending transmission of COVID. COVID will continue to circulate. But we do believe that there will be enough vaccine to protect, you know, all healthcare workers around the world, which means healthcare systems continuing to function and not having to implement the kinds of draconian economic lockdowns that we've had to put in place. And we also think there'll be enough vaccine to protect the most vulnerable populations, potentially in every country. And if you can do that, if you can take the morbidity and mortality and stress on the healthcare systems out of the pandemic, you can transform it from being this terrible event that we've all been living through to something a lot more like 2009, which most people have forgotten about. And to do that quickly, you have to distribute the vaccine globally in an equitable fashion. What we have happening right now is, you know, we call it the equity clock is ticking. You see, you know, images being transmitted around the world of people being vaccinated in the US, in the UK, in Israel, and the vast majority of countries where the vast majority of people live don't have access to vaccine right now. And COVAX was created to, you know, try to accelerate the delivery of these life-saving medical products globally in a fashion that would promote all of the countries, you know, rapidly vaccinating their healthcare workforces and their most vulnerable populations. And we are, one of the big challenges that we're seeing as we have entered into this intense winter wave is, you know, the political panic that goes along with that, which is creating a scramble for a constrained vaccine supply, which of course is what we anticipated. And fortunately, just before Christmas, we were able to announce that COVAX had secured around 2 billion doses of vaccine through agreements with AstraZeneca, Sanofi, Johnson & Johnson, and Serum Institute of India, which will provide both the AstraZeneca and Novavax vaccines, over the next couple of years, and that we have access agreements where we can't announce the names of the companies yet for another billion doses in 2021. So that's 3 billion doses in aggregate that COVAX will be able to distribute globally, which offsets, I think, to some extent, this scramble for vaccine that we're seeing.
You know, I want to spend the last few minutes here asking both of you a question that I think a lot of our audience, a lot of corporate America is grappling with, which is, it's tempting, obviously, to always fight the last war in a sense. And obviously, we have to get through this pandemic. And I don't want to downplay how much further we have to go, obviously. But as we think further out, if we think about the changes that corporate America has had to go through after various crises in the past, whether it's 9/11 or other, other issues, what's the takeaway here from this in terms of biological threats? I mean, it seems like we've treated these as a series of one-off anomalies, where the reality of it is, I think in a conversation you and I had the other day, Richard, you put it very well in the sense that it's more like the cyber threat. It's constant, it's coming, and it's a cost of doing business to protect against that now. But what's your recommendation or view, and Jerry, I'd love to hear your view here as well, in terms of how corporations need to think about mitigating ongoing biological threats?
Sure. Maybe I'll jump in and answer quickly, and then let Jerry have the last word. I think the analogy to the cyber threats that you mentioned is a really good one. We have constructed a highly connected world, with dense cities, mega cities in developing countries, where continuing to make incursions into previously remote areas. You can get anywhere to anywhere in the world in 24 hours. So we've created a perfect opportunity ground for new viruses. And the steady drumbeat of emerging diseases that we've seen over the last few decades, H1N1, bird flu, Ebola, MERS, Zika, now COVID, this is the reality that we live in. And this is if we want to have a world that operates like the world was operating before COVID, if we want to get back to that or even close to back to that, then we need to address these risks systematically and in a much more comprehensive way. And that's where the cyber analogy is useful, because we've internalized that we have to address cyber risk. And so we do. And I think The cyber is also a good analogy, because we've done that. We haven't just turned that over to governments. We've figured out ways to monetize it. We have created public-private partnerships. Government has a role. The private sector has a role. And I think corporations globally and corporate America need to think about how they can step up, because we all want to get back to that free-flowing, efficient world that we lived in before. But if we don't address biological risks systematically, we will have an event that is bigger than COVID and more damaging than COVID, and that is a certainty.
And Jerry, the challenge then is, given what Richard just said, the certainty and bigger than COVID, but the timing of that is just an obvious unknown. How do companies integrate that into the threat matrix that they're having to adjust to every day?
Well, Kevin, historically companies put their most attention and the most funding into high probability events, and often ignore low probability events. I think Richard's point is it rings true, in that this is here. We've seen it. We saw it back during the anthrax attacks. People's memories are short. They forgot about planning for these types of events. And now we've had a significant reminder of the impact of an event like this, so that biological events, whether it's naturally occurring or it's an intentional event, those threats are here to stay. And corporations need to ensure they bring that planning way up to the top, along with some of the more common things they plan for. Because I think most corporations have now seen the financial impact these type of events can have on their bottom line.
So there you have it. I'm Kevin Kachiwara. Thank you so much for joining us for this episode of Teneo Insights. If you have any questions about any of the topics we cover, please reach out to us at teneoinsights@teneo.com. See you next time.